1320 AM, W248DE, Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. Despite rail system arsons and rain, Paris pulls off its Summer Olympics opening ceremony. Organizer Tony Estanguet tells athletes,
"Welcome to Paris. Welcome to your moment in history. Live it, love it, and carry us with you. The world is on your side."
GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump stumping in Florida brings up Vice President Kamala Harris, who says she has signed the forms officially declaring her candidacy for president.
"This week, many of those Kamala Harris supporters burned American flags in the heart of our nation's capital and desecrated our monuments. Did you see? They sprayed very powerful spray paint into limestone."
Wildfires rage in the west. A fire in Chico, California, 0% contained. Nearby resident Roy Gordon had to evacuate.
"Very worried. I want to go home right now. But those things can be replaced. Lives can't. Pets can't."
CBS News Brief. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Civic Media News, I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Senator Tammy Baldwin is introducing a bill to protect communities from sudden hospital closures. As James Kelly reports, it's a response to what happened in Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls this year.
The new legislation is meant to protect communities from the sudden closure of essential hospitals. If passed into law, a closing hospital system would be required to notify the Department of Health and Human Services and develop a plan with public input to connect patients with accessible care. The notification would be required at least 90 days in advance of the closure. I'm James Kelly.
Baldwin is running for re-election against challenger Eric Hovde. Emerald ash borers have been found in all 72 Wisconsin counties as of Friday. The tree-killing pest was first spotted in Wisconsin in 2008. The Department of Natural Resources says one day they'll kill virtually all of Wisconsin's ash trees. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
Ready, set, go. Get in the game and be heard with WFHR's Playmakers. Join us 5 to 6 Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. We're here to take your calls, sports takes, and ramblings. We'll have breaking stories, game day conversations with players, coaches, and you. Nobody ever made a highlight from the sidelines. Join the team here at WFHR 97.5 FM, 1320 AM, 5 to 6 PM Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for WFHR's Playmakers.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Oh boy, lots to talk about. What a week it's been. I got to tell you, I haven't seen Democrats this energized, this mobilized, this focused, this driven in maybe since the Obama years, the early years. Maybe since that hope and change resonated with people, especially young people, to get out and say, "Hey, we can take on the world." I see this being one of those moments where we're going to save the world. So, you know, maybe the hope and the change is part, but the saving the country, that kind of a motivating factor. And look, money flowing into the Kamala Harris campaign, volunteers in huge numbers flowing into the campaign, energy in places that there hadn't been before. Great stuff. I got a friend in Philly who said, "Look, you're starting to see some energy." That is good news for Pennsylvania, good news for Bob Casey. If you get a number of folks out to vote in Philly, Democrats stand a better chance. And Republicans understand this. Tom Corbett, who ran for governor back, was governor back in 2010, was quoted as saying, "We'll do okay if we can keep the vote down in Philly." Now, again, dog whistle, don't want those people to vote. And sadly, people in Philly didn't come out in the numbers that needed, and Corbett won. So understand, you got to understand getting your base out. I think Kamala Harris energizes that base. I think, and I hope, look, the first couple of days have been fantastic. They've managed this pretty well. even in the face of the Republican idiocy. But I got to tell you, you know, I watched President Biden's, basically his farewell speech, if you will, and, you know, was heartbroken, you know, quite frankly, because I love Joe Biden. I think he has done some amazing things for the country, especially these last 3.5 years. And to watch someone deteriorate in that way, and it made me sad. And then to hear the attacks and the viciousness coming from the other side, it's heartbreaking. Now, as I said from the beginning, you know, after that Thursday debate, I said, look, I in my heart of hearts, I know Joe Biden's going to do what's in the best interest of the country. And you saw that during his speech. It wasn't in his self-interest to step aside and pass the mantle. It wasn't in his best interest to do that. It was in the country's best interest, and he understood that. And I think perfectly timed it. The RNC had their big party. Didn't really get a bump coming out of the party. They had their political theater. They had their whole song and dance, and you're bringing out some... Hulk Hogan was there. Okay. Going to be interesting to see how the next week goes. This first week has been all about the love, the unity, now going to sharpen the nails and begin the attack. And Republicans haven't figured out how they're going to deal with Kamala Harris. What's interesting, when you have the House Republican leadership begging members to please don't attack her on race lines. Please don't attack her gender. Please stop making racial and you know, stop. Just don't do it. You know, we'll get you something else down the road. We'll say this was a bloodless coup. You know, that she's an evil, you know, backstabber that pushed poor Joe Biden out. We'll get you something. We'll make something up. But whatever you do, for the love of all above, don't say the stuff that you're thinking. Don't say the stuff that's in your DNA. Don't call her the DEI candidate. And look, Republicans can't help themselves. Racism and misogyny, that's their stock in trade. It's the tool in the box. It literally is the only tool in the box. And I look at Republican Representative Glenn Grotham from Wisconsin, who said, well, she's the nominee only because of her ethnic background. That's a nicer way of saying her race. You got Judicial Watch's right-wing conservative activist, this Tom Fitton, you know, going back to the birther. We had to go back to the bag of tricks for birtherism. You know, going, well, you know, that Jamaican, South Asian, you know, those parents, that could make her ineligible to run for president. Yeah, someone did that. Kellyanne Conway went to the old, trusted, the true, the time-honored classic. She doesn't speak well. She doesn't work hard. She doesn't inspire anyone. I don't know. I think she ripped pretty good into Brett Kavanaugh during his confirmation hearing. I think she's done a pretty good job of doing the work and inspiring a lot of people to come out of the woodwork and volunteer for the campaign and dig into their pocket and donate some money. I think she's done pretty good on that there, Kellyanne. And of course, Republican Representative Harriet Hagman, who said, you know, she is the ultimate, you know, in DEI candidate, said intellectually, just really kind of the bottom of the barrel. So, you know, understand, not new. None of this stuff new. This is true, tried, tested, think tank tested, you know, focus group tested, think tank approved. But for 2008. Because understand, this is exactly what conservatives tried on Barack Obama. That he was, you know, he's lazy, he didn't work hard. He was the affirmative action president. Remember that? And understand, the reason they didn't use DEI back then is DEI wasn't a thing. We didn't have that yet. They have upgraded their rhetoric. They have evolved with their racism, and it's no longer affirmative action president. It's DEI. And the great thing is, and the reason they can get away with this, is most people don't know what DEI stands for. You know, diversity, equity, and inclusion, which means that, you know, everyone, all of us. Kind of like that whole, you know, the whole Constitution thing. Endowed by our creators. All men created equal. Not men in the gender way, but, you know, mankind. It's really just amazing that they can't help themselves. Now, the weird thing here is when the National Review says that Trump's appeal to union members is cultural and not ideological, this is what they mean. Because when Republicans repeat this stuff over and over and over again, you know, these divisive words, these, you know, there she's the DEI, affirmative action candidate. She's, you know, she doesn't speak very well. You know, those people. It's playing into that cultural stereotype that is their stock in trade. This is how they get working class people to vote against their own interests. And the fact that the National Review recognizes this, the fact that the National Review, one of the oldest, most respected conservative publications in the country, is saying the appeal's cultural. It's not ideological. It's be afraid of that person that looks different, not of the policies that have been making our lives worse. And for me, as a working class person, I look at both administrations. I look at the Trump administration. I look at the Biden-Harris administration. And you go, which one has done better for working people? I look at all of the attacks that Trump and his people did on union issues. I look at all of the tax breaks that they gave to rich people. I look at all of the mechanisms of government to give the rich and the powerful more wealth and power and, well, working people less of a voice. I look at Biden, who has run on a campaign of bottom up, middle out. This idea that we're gonna help the people on the bottom, we're gonna raise them up, and ultimately it's good, things are gonna trickle up, things are gonna float upward. That's the right way of doing things. Something I've been saying for almost 20 years of doing 19 years of doing this program. That when you give working class people an opportunity to earn a good living, to have disposable income, it makes everybody better off. And this is part of that. Now, understand, we're not going to see the end of the racism and the misogyny and all that and the weaponizing of government, because I'm sure you saw the other day that Tennessee Republican Andy Ogles introduced a resolution to impeach Harris for high crimes and misdemeanors, because evidently, you know, she's in charge. So what they're saying is Biden made her the border czar. And, well, you know, we haven't sealed off the border. So they're going to use impeachment as a tool to try and diminish her. And look, all it is an outrage tool. There's nothing there. Go ahead. And I said, go ahead. File for impeachment. Have a hearing. Let's give Kamala Harris 24/7 news coverage and suck all of the oxygen out of the air for Donald Trump. And if I'm Kamala Harris, all of these attacks, all of this hatred, all of this misogyny, all of this racism, bring it. Bring it on. Bring all of it. Be as racist and as misogynistic as you can be. Let it all out. Let it be freeing. Let it be that singing in the poppy fields, running through the woods. Be all of that you can be, Republicans. Because the reality is when she beats Trump like a dirty rug in the debates that Trump has said he's willing to have, and he ends up looking sadly like Joe Biden looked on that Thursday night debate, then there's going to be none of that, oh, well, she doesn't speak very well, oh, you know, she's lazy. There's going to be none of that. There's going to be a black woman kicked your butt and is going to get elected as president of these United States. And is going to continue the legacy that Joe Biden has, the path that he has put us on, and the policies that are going to make lives better. That's going to be the argument. That's going to be the campaign going forward. And you can have all the political stunts you want. You can bring in a labor leader looking for attention because he thinks he's Mr. Art of the Deal. You can do all of those things. It's not going to matter. Because the American people don't want to hear this kind of divisive talk. They want to hear, how are you going to make our lives better? What policies are you going to bring us? Remember, you know, Donald Trump says a lot of things. There are a lot of words, a lot of the very best words, just no policy to back it up. And the reality is when he comes out with that health care plan he promised us years ago, then maybe I'll listen. Until then, sorry, we've seen this movie. It was bad, the first one. A sequel would be much, much worse. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. When we come back, we're going to talk about heat, worker safety, you know, things the GOP claims that they're in favor of. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we talked about yesterday, OSHA has come out and proposed a new safety standard. One of the very few that the Biden administration has actually moved on. And look, I'm expecting if there is some continuity going forward, that the administration of the Joe Biden will bring us some new standards in the second term, because these take a long time. But this one is to protect workers in extreme heat environments. You know, as someone who has worked in extreme heat environments, very happy to see finally after, well, I've been doing my job about 35 years. Nice to see finally we're going to address this issue, especially as the climate is, well, getting warmer. And you remember yesterday we talked with Jordan Barab, former OSHA chief, who said, look, you know, went to this subcommittee hearing. And it was all about bashing this proposal. And I love the title, Safeguarding Workers and Employers from OSHA Overreach and Skewed Priorities. You know, keeping workers safe, somehow a skewed priority. So I thought it'd be a good idea to reach out to someone who knows what this kind of regulation means in her state, because Oregon's already done what the national OSHA wants to do. Good on Oregon. And that's why I've asked Katie Sussman to come talk to us. Katie's the executive director of Safe Jobs Oregon, also the Northwest Worker Justice Project, their website, nwjp.org. Katie, thanks for taking time for us.
You're so welcome. It's great to be here.
So let's go through this because, you know, yesterday on the program, we were talking with Jordan about this this heat standard, which it's about time, long time in the making, desperately needed. And, you know, he said, you know, look, you got all these the employers, the fire chief, all these people, you know, saying how horrible this is going to be. It's going to be bad for business, and not so much concern about, you know, the people who are going to be dying from this.
Yeah, I watched some of that hearing. It was a disaster. I'm glad Jordan was there. But I can tell you just from the experience of having had a heat rule in Oregon for a couple of years now, we're doing fine. Our economy was not impacted by this. Employers are still doing just as they were. The difference is that workers have real protections. So when it's too hot out, employers have to do certain things and workers can refer to those things. They've been trained on them in some cases. They've heard from others. We have the right to more rest, more paid breaks, more water. So you can do this. States can do it. And it's wonderful to see the federal government catching up and doing the same thing at the federal level.
No, absolutely. Fingers crossed. You know, for me, the federal government sets the bottom floor. States can do better. I want them to do better. But, you know, the idea that you can get shade when it's hot and water when you're dehydrating, that seems like a simple, common sense no-brainer. But interesting, one of the things that came out of that hearing is, you know, people going, well, if you're thirsty, just go get a drink of water. And if you need to take a break, yeah, go ahead. Go take that break. And my mind immediately goes to, in what world do you live? Because I got to tell you, most employers, I don't think they'd be thrilled with that.
Exactly. And that's why it's so important to have those rights on paper. And for employers, you know, not all employers, but some employers do learn about the new rules and regulations and do follow them. A good number don't. And we mostly work with workers in low wage jobs. And so those are the folks who are, you know, least likely to have that employer who's really up on all the new rules and following them to the T. So those are the workers that we try to do a lot of outreach to, trainings, and make sure people can stand up for themselves, often with coworkers or on their own, and say, hey, I have the right to these things. I'm not going to risk my life for you.
No, this is a situation where the good employers, the people who you just pointed out, you know, want their employees to do what they need to do to stay safe, they're going to be fine. It's these low road bottom feeders that they're the problem.
So, yeah, you know, no, exactly.
So, you know, I look at Oregon, you know, you guys, you went through, you passed this rule. Why, you know, what prompted this move to do this? Because it usually, sadly, we only do things out of tragedy. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the reports, you know, hundreds of people are dying across the country of heat related illnesses. I'm sure there's a tragedy behind the story that you're about to tell.
Yeah, no, there is. You know, we were proactive in fighting for this rule before we had seen heat deaths at work as a common occurrence, because Oregon, like many states, is just so much hotter than it was 10, 20 years ago. So we started advocating, my group and others, unions and other folks in Oregon started advocating for a state heat rule back in 2016. At that time, Oregon OSHA thought they had other priorities and they weren't ready to move forward on it. We kept at them about it. And we then had some good, bad luck in that the Republicans in Oregon decided to walk out over a climate bill that our then governor, Kate Brown, was pushing forward around a carbon tax. They walked out. She said, well, what can I do on my own with an executive order? And she did this very broad executive order. One of the things it mandated was that Oregon OSHA and the Oregon Health Authority work together to pass an extreme heat rule and a wildfire smoke rule. So that's great. You know, we were on the path to doing that. But as you already mentioned, these things take time. So my group and a few other groups in Oregon said, okay, we're doing rulemaking. We'll participate. It'll take years. Let's do an emergency heat standard now, because it's extremely hot in Oregon. It's predicted to be real hot. This is the summer of 2021. And Oregon OSHA said, well, we don't think we need the emergency rule. Let's just let this thing run its course. Well, then we had this event called the heat dome, which none of us had ever heard of. But 2021 in July, we had a crazy heat dome. Temperatures, instead of being in the 80s, were 110 and above in much of Oregon. And there was a really tragic death of a farm worker in the Willamette Valley who was a new worker, which is a risk factor. So not acclimated. He was working alone, another risk factor. He was doing heavy work with an irrigation pipe, and he passed out and eventually passed away from heat exposure. We as advocates were, you know, we were devastated by the loss of that farm worker and a number of other workers that eventually throughout, you know, learning about the effects of the heat dome, not just a lot of Oregonians died, but we think four or five workers also died. At that point, Oregon OSHA said, let's do the emergency rule. We got an emergency rule in 2021 in July, continued the rulemaking, and got our permanent rules in the following summer, 2022.
You know, it sounds like it shouldn't be this difficult. I mean, you know, it sounds like, you know, the common sense part of this is, you know, we protect workers. The common sense part of this should be that, you know, you shouldn't be working alone in extreme heat, doing heavy manual labor without someone, you know, looking out for your safety. A lot of this sounds like common sense, which is why I'm such a big supporter of labor unions. You know, in a union environment, there's a grievance procedure. There's a negotiation that can happen during contract time. There's the ability to go, I'm just not doing it.
Yeah.
And this is where I've been fortunate. And I've said this for years. You know, I've never knowingly taken an unsafe vehicle on the highway as a truck driver because I have the ability and the empowerment to say no in dangerous situations. This, for me, is why every person in this country should have a union contract and a union card in their back pocket to ensure that these kind of situations aren't this problematic, that if you are feeling stressed from the heat or thirsty or any of this stuff, that you're empowered to go take care of yourself and not have to worry about being fired.
That's right. I do have to point out that ag workers, farm workers, are excluded from the NLRA, which gives us the right to form a union. And that's a long-standing federal exemption for agricultural workers, who are some of the most at risk. And workers can still build power. Workers can still act together to stand up for themselves, even when they're not protected by the National Labor Relations Act. But it's a lot harder and it's a lot scarier. So I appreciate everything you just said. And for sure, I wish every worker had a union. And I wish every worker was covered by the NLRA and could have a union.
And again, this is why, major comprehensive labor laws reform is so desperately necessary. And voting in November for the right people. I mean, and I'm not going to pull you into a political discussion. But the reality is who we put into the White House decides who is the head of the NLRB, who's the head of the Department of Labor, who is the head of OSHA. All of this stuff filters down from the top. And if the goal is to protect workers, as I believe the Biden administration has done, then you're going to see these kind of rulemakings happen. If you go a different direction, we've seen what 4 years of Donald Trump brought us on. It wasn't great. But for me personally, and again, you're not involved in this, this is one of those which side are you on moments. So the question I've got for you, in looking at this, because you pointed out that Oregon is a state that has OSHA. There are 23 states in the country, including mine here in Pennsylvania, that does not have OSHA protections for public sector workers.
Right.
What should people be doing in their home states to push this on the state level to where, even if this rule comes into play on the federal level, that we make them stronger, better enforced, and people actually get to know about them?
That's absolutely right. Hopefully we get this federal rule, and that's going to take some years. I'm sure Jordan Barrett talked about it yesterday, but we're probably 2 years out from this thing offering protections at the federal level in the best case scenario. So in the meantime, each state that has its own state plan should be thinking about their own heat rule. And you can advocate. I mean, I recommend advocating with unions, with community groups, with academics and researchers who can prove why this is so important, and advocate to your state plan, advocate to your state legislature and your governor about why that state needs to protect workers. And this is, think about the South, where all those workers, probably don't have, maybe they don't even have a state labor agency, don't have a state OSHA plan. Those workers really are on their own and they need this federal rule more than anyone. But in our own states where we do have a state plan OSHA, I highly recommend getting a strong coalition together, going to advocate for yourself to put your own state-based plan that works for your state in effect now, and don't wait years.
Yeah. Now, this is another one of those things that the which side are you on scenario of, are you on the side of workers or are you on the side of bad bosses? And, how you fund OSHA, how you resource OSHA, to me is one of those bellwethers. If you see somebody, go back to the Reagan era, Republicans throughout the Reagan era forward have all cut the funding to OSHA. The number of inspectors have gone down. The opportunities to inspect workplaces have taken much, much longer. In fact, I think, what are we at, 186 years for OSHA with its current staffing level to inspect every business in this country? 186 years. That does not instill great confidence in me, Katie.
That's right. And workers know that, workers understand that. One other thing that we can do now, and I'd love to just give a little shout out to the National COSH organization. And we're a member of this really powerful national coalition with folks like me who are working on worker safety and health issues. And National COSH has an important petition up on their website that's asking the Biden administration to move as quickly as possible on this rulemaking for the federal heat standard. So that's nationalcosh.org. And there's a ton of great information on how to protect yourself from heat and then how to sign this petition where we're asking for that, really quick movement on the federal heat standard.
And we'll get links out on social media how folks can do that. And National COSH stands for the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health. So folks know these are the folks who pay attention to this stuff. And I'm grateful that they and you do this, because this is something our corporate-controlled mainstream media just never touches.
That's right. That's right. And these stories are heartbreaking. You know, workers in low-wage jobs, often without a union, going into dangerous situations just so their boss can make a buck. And their lives are more important. And folks know that. And that's what National COSH is helping people do. Yeah. Stand up for themselves. Talk about the value of their work and their life.
Sadly, I've always said if I wanted to kill somebody, I'd just give them a job. I'd get away with it, because we don't go after employers when they do horrible things. But Katie, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Good stuff. Great story. Thanks so much.
So great to be with you. Thank you.
Katie Sussman, Executive Director of Safe Jobs Oregon Northwest Worker Justice Project. Check out their website, nwjp.org. We'll get links out on social media so you can take a look at that. I want to hear your thoughts. Does your state have a state OSHA? Do you have a heat standard in your state? Or are you one of, like many? You're on your own, brother. Again, another reason I think you need a union. Back after this.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids' home of Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear tonight, a low in the upper 50s. Mostly sunny, hot, and humid for the weekend, highs in the mid-80s. Storms possible Sunday night, Monday. Another warm day with a high in the mid-80s. Most of the rest of next week looks drier and staying warm. It's 69 degrees right now.
To everyone making time for life's best moments, let our team member Sandy share how Culver's is serving up celebration by the scoop.
Our rich and creamy fresh frozen custard makes every day a little bit sweeter. Enjoying a handcrafted treat with all the ooey gooey toppings you love, now that's worth celebrating.
Come to Culver's and let us serve you a sweet treat to make every moment count.
From Wisconsin with love,
welcome to Delicious.
Culver's, 8th Street South, Wisconsin Rapids.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I came across this story about the Pennsylvania state system of higher education, the overseer of all the state-owned universities in my state here in Pennsylvania, and how evidently, they earned in 2024 this Exceptional Agency Award, handed out by the State Higher Education Executive Officers Association. I'm not sure what this is. I'm not sure if it's a self-licking ice cream cone or what the deal is, but we won an award. And almost immediately, you see that the chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, a guy named Dan Greenstein, he's resigning, right? And I saw this in the story. He said he sees national opportunities going forward because they did this system redesign that was highlighted by the State Higher Education Association's executive officers, or you know, whatever that is. So you've got this redesign, how he's redone the state system. And the question I have is this something we want to see on a broader scale? So I decided to bring in my good friend Ken Mash. He's the president of the Association of Pennsylvania State College and University Faculties, appscuff.org, the website. Ken, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here, Rick.
So let's start with this award. Is this something that we as taxpayers in the state, we as citizens, students, something we should be proud of?
I don't see any reason why anyone should be proud except the people, I suppose, who got it. I mean, this is one of those things where, it's like giving yourself an award, right? They're part of this organization. They get an award. It's a circle. That's really, in essence, what it is. Sorry to use the crude language, Rick, but it's not.
It is what it is. I'm not sure if I have to bleep that or not, but no. Look, the reality is that that's kind of what I thought. And, you know, as I was reading through the article and they were talking about this system redesign, which is a very nice way of saying boogering up, you know, what we once had here in this state, which were 14 state-owned institutions that were here for working-class kids to get a college education and have an opportunity at a better future, that they have now shrunk down. So I don't think that's a system redesign. I think that's hatcheting at the system. But I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Well, you know, things are complex. There were multiple aspects to the system redesign. One of them was increased transparency, and I'll give credit where credit is due. They have made the finances and the operations more transparent than they have ever been. You know, one has been a focus on affordability, and it's true that the state system has not raised its tuition in 7 years. So that's a pretty big deal. But, you know, in a way, it's kind of a deal with the devil, because in order to get increases in our budget that will allow us to keep tuition low, what they've done is been responsive to calls to reduce the size of the faculty, the size of the administrations, and to consolidate, you know, to consolidate universities. So we had 14, now we have 10. So there were two universities that used to be six universities. And, you know, to say that it's been a success, that would just not be true. I mean, there's been lots of issues that have involved, you know, the poor planning that was involved in doing it. There's issues with concern to the students who are on those campuses who now have to, in essence, take distance ed courses in order to be able to finish their degrees, because, you know, there's one department across three different campuses, which can be, you know, 100 or so miles apart. And your only option is to sit in a room and have the video sent to you. And that's not necessarily an experience that students really wanted. So, you know, we've seen enrollment problems continue at those universities. And so to call it a success is really pushing it.
No, it sounds like the idea is, you know, it's one of those, we're saving it by killing it.
Right. And then on top of that, you know, there's been all this cost-cutting measures, some things which are just completely illogical. And, you know, while I say that they've been transparent and the chancellor has professed, you know, over the years, many, many times, his reliance on data, what they've done is they've compared their like faculty complement to 2011. And the notable thing about 2011 is that was when we were at our high point in enrollment. And in fact, we had more students at our universities that we could handle during that year. So to compare what, you know, to compare now to then is just ridiculous.
Yeah, no, I look at this as, you know, and I've said, you know, for a very long time, the PASHE system, the entire, all the state-owned universities are like the, you know, the golden gem of education in this country, because it's not there for the purpose of making money. It's not there for the purpose of, you know, increasing their endowments. It's there to educate working class kids. It's there to give people an opportunity that might not otherwise happen, and it should be somewhat local, so that, you know, you're not, you know, having to travel 100 miles to take a class or take a meeting. And that, for me, how it was, you know, located around the state was a good thing. And yeah. I see this redesign as, well, we're going towards the business of education instead of education.
Our universities are publicly owned universities, like they are in many states, in most states. They're the engines of the middle class, that is, to move people from lower working class into the middle class so that they can get jobs that will help them and, you know, get jobs, have a career, but also be prepared in this economy where we know that people have to change their jobs several times. That's part of the reason why you go to college, is that you need to be prepared to do shifts in your career path along the way and change jobs and have the kind of background that allows you to have the skills, the core skills of, you know, writing, speaking, critical thinking that allow you to make that move smoothly.
Yeah. No, I was watching an interview with Mark Cuban he used to own the Dallas Mavericks, billionaire guy, saying that, you know, in the next 5, 10, 15 years, a liberal arts degree is going to be one of the most important degrees to have. Because of just the things that you pointed out, that, you know, you're throughout your life, you're going to have to change, be flexible, be nimble, and have those skills that, you know, you can't absolutely define, but being able to learn new things and be adaptable, that's the future, he said.
Yeah, and the leaders of AI have come out right and said it, like, we're not really looking, or they don't see the future being in tech or in coding. With AI, it's going to be, how do you turn AI into something that is usable for the average person? And to do so, you have to be able to communicate clearly yourself so that you can help communicate with others. So they've actually been stressing to people, just future students, you should look at the liberal arts, look at the humanities, so that you're prepared for the future.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, you know, for years, all we heard is, well, you know, these worthless liberal arts degrees, probably because the word liberal was in it. You know, these are worthless. We need people with hard, tangible skills to get a job. And now we're going back to, no, we want critical thinkers. We want people who, you know, can use tools better. Or isn't it kind of amazing?
I don't know. Maybe I'm hearing echoes because I think I'm still hearing some of that, that they're not even listening to the people who are talking now. And there's still a lot of people out there who are critical of college degrees, critical of faculty, and critical of, you know, you hear all this talk regularly about, you know, is a college degree necessary? The data shows that, yes, you do much better over the course of your lifetime, even with it being expensive. To, you know, with a college degree, but, you know, I think you hit on it. This is not an argument based on facts. It's an argument based on politics and ideology.
Yeah. Now, I'm looking at this redesign and this great award from the State Higher Education Executive Officers Association. Got it right that time. You know, has now given this guy a, you know, something to put on his mantle, but also national opportunities. So in looking at it from the frame of national opportunities, you know, what this chancellor has done here in Pennsylvania, is this something we want expanded across the country? Is this a redesign we'd like to see to go national?
Again, like I try not to be overly reductionistic or simplistic. So I think that there are good things you can point to that the chancellor has achieved during his time as chancellor. But there's been a whole lot of baggage. There's been a whole lot of entertaining of bad ideas, which, you know, thank goodness that our union and our colleagues in other unions and particularly in the House, among the Democrats in the House, in the General Assembly in Pennsylvania, have been able to fight back against, too. So, you know, one of those being, for example, they had the idea for a 3-year baccalaureate degree so that you can get your 4-year college degree in 3 years. And they tried to get that through the Pennsylvania Department of Education, but they were not successful in doing so.
So you can't do a 4-year degree in 3 years? I mean, it'd be a lot of work. You'd have to work through the summers, but I know people who have finished their degrees in 3 years.
So what we're talking about here is not that you can't possibly do that. I mean, it's still a matter of you have to graduate with 120 credits, 4 years worth of credits.
Right.
But, you know, if you accumulate credits with AP courses or dual enrollment courses, so you come in with a bunch of credits or you take some summer classes maybe, right, you can achieve it in 3 years. It's going to be hard work to do. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about this uncommonly stupid idea that you should reduce the number of credits that's required to get a bachelor's degree and still call it a bachelor's
degree. Wait. Let me guess which credits we're cutting. Let me take a wild guess. Humanities, anything that the arts, music, any of the liberal, any of that liberal stuff.
Right. The stuff that others have told you don't need, but are in fact the very things that number one has made the American higher education system the envy of the world, because there's a lot of admiration for the fact that there's credit, you know, that our students come away with critical thinking skills and are able to adjust in a way that workers in other places are not able to. I'll say that it has never been the case that a college degree is just about getting a job either. And that's really what people are trying to turn it into, is it's just a career tech plan. And, you know, when I bet back in the Gilded Age, when only rich people went to college, and they went to college and they got went to their fancy schools and they got their 4-year baccalaureate degrees, they weren't doing it because their family couldn't get them jobs, right? Like, that's not why they were going to college. They were going to college because it was well understood that in order to be successful, to be the best person that you can possibly be, right, you should really have exposure to many different ways of thinking about the world.
You know, it's interesting, as I'm hearing you talk, I was remembering a quote from, you know, a research project I did back when I was in college years and years ago, and it was on child labor. And there was like a CEO, Robert Barron type, and his name eludes me, but he said, you know, too much education can spoil people for work.
Right.
And you know, I see that we're living kind of in that world where that theme is softly, maybe quietly coming back, but it's certainly coming back.
And, you know, there's part of it's rooted in, I will be nice and say that there's some good faith argument in it, in saying, hey, college is really expensive, we want to make it more affordable. I'm less convinced that there's also an argument about, like, employers wanting this. I haven't seen any real data that suggests that this is an overwhelming demand on the part of employers to have 3-year degrees. What I really fear most, Rick, is that we are going to create a two-tiered system, a segregated system, where rich kids will continue to go to elite schools. They will get their 4-year degrees. Students in the working class will be sort of pushed to go into these 3-year degrees. They'll come out of it, but they will not have gotten the same experience.
Yeah, but haven't we already done that, Ken? I mean, yeah, I look at all this online stuff. You can get your online degree from the University of whatever. And, you know, it's the same as the Ivy League schools. In fact, the one, you know, said that they were accredited by the same accreditation agency as the Ivy League schools. And it's a crummy online degree where you don't get any experience other than you read a book and you write a couple of things.
Yeah. So, you know, it is buyer beware too often when it comes to college with online experiences. Of course, students can learn online. That's not the argument that we would make. And certainly, you know, from the perspective of my colleagues, we would rather students have opportunities, right? And if their only opportunity is to do it online, as long as it's done well,
right.
And, you know, but we're not going to argue it's equal, but it's a better circumstance. But we've seen lots of, you know, there were pressures to get down to 120 credits, because I'm old enough to remember that many of the universities, in fact, required more than 120 credits to graduate, because that was the belief in it. But I don't understand, really, when you have, and there's an accrediting agency that says that it's going to move forward and start doing this in the middle of the country. You know, to me, it really, you know, these are people who are supposed to be concerned about higher ed, and they're really kind of masochists. They can't possibly believe in the thing that they're supposed to be accrediting if they're going to make the argument with a straight face that it's the same thing if you take 120 credits as if you take 90 credits.
It's amazing. But again, it comes back to the question I ask all the time. What's the purpose of education? Is it to get you a job or make you a critical thinking citizen? And depending on how you answer that question, I can tell you how you're probably going to vote.
I'll tell you, I think it's both. I understand why people, I don't think that's new, that people would go to college in order to be able to get, to be able to have a good career. But it's that critical thinking part of it that's really going to make the difference. And, you know, and people, not every, look, I've had legislators say to me, you know, not every student should go to college. And I respond to them, look, I'm a faculty member. My colleagues and I completely agree, right, that not everybody should be going to college. We've had the experience with students who probably shouldn't have gone to college. But what we want to see is that every student in Pennsylvania, every student across the country should have, that they have the opportunity to get the kinds of experiences that, you know, those people who are in the upper echelon, we'll say, have.
Education is the great equalizer. I'm right there with you. Ken, as always, I appreciate the time, the information. Last question, should we be worried about this kind of thing going national? Should we be worried about the national opportunities? Yes, no?
As far as the three-year degrees, I think that that's really something that's percolating right now. And yes, I will not be shocked to see that it happens. As far as consolidations, we hear that, yeah, there are other states looking to do these kinds of things, close down universities, shut down universities. The outlook is not great for higher education. Mm-hmm. And we really need people to understand that our universities, ours in Pennsylvania and across the country, the public universities really are the universities of the working class people, right? That's the people that's the students we serve.
Ken Mash, thanks so much. Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
President of the Association of Pennsylvania State College and University Faculties, appscuff.org, the website. Want to hear your thoughts. Is it concerning to you, this, in my view, privatization, profitization of higher ed? And we see it trickling down to the K-12 area. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1990. That was the day that George H.W. Bush signed into law the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA prohibits employment discrimination of people with disabilities and requires public accommodations to be accessible. The passage of the act was the result of years of grassroots organizing by members of the ADA community and their allies. When President Bush signed the law, he said that if he had to thank everyone who had been involved, we'd never get out of here before sunset. The passage of the act had bipartisan support, but many business leaders worried about the ADA's effect, fearing the costs of accessibility accommodations to their bottom lines. While most business leaders did not oppose the act outright, they did push for amendments and concessions to weaken its impact. The business newspaper, The Wall Street Journal, called the act, quote, the Lawyers' Employment Act, warning that a flood of lawsuits on disability issues would harm businesses. In signing the bill, President Bush addressed business leaders specifically. He said, quote, you've called for new sources of workers. Well, many of our fellow citizens with disabilities are unemployed. They want to work and they can work. And this is a tremendous pool of people. And remember, this is a tremendous pool of people who will bring to jobs diversity, loyalty, proven low turnover rate, and only one request, the chance to prove themselves. The passage of the ADA paved the way for fundamental changes in America's infrastructure, such as accessibility ramps, spots for wheelchairs on buses and subways, and parking accommodations. This was a major step forward, yet more work remains in order to build a society truly accessible to all. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, I was thinking about LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, former president. And look, you know, this election cycle, kind of some parallels. A lot of people talking about the 68 convention in Chicago, 2024 convention in Chicago. Supposedly a lot of turmoil going to happen. Interestingly, we now find out from John Kirby that all of the money that's, you know, propped up this Hamas defense coming from Iran, not surprised at all, but interesting. So when I saw this story about J.D. Vance, Evidently, there's a story that he has an affinity for sofas, for couches. It got me to thinking. Now, understand, the story is not true, but it got me to thinking about LBJ, who evidently, as legend has it, during a congressional campaign, said that he called himself a pig blanker. You know what I'm... has sex with pigs. And his campaign manager said, Lyndon, yeah, you know that guy doesn't do that. And supposedly, as legend has it, LBJ said, I know, I just want to make him deny it. I just want to hear him deny it. And this plays right into this frame, because you've got J.D. Vance, who now some of the social media folks have accused him through his book, The Hillbilly Elegy, of engaging in some type of teenage activity without his hands, using a glove and some couch cushions. And you go, oh, that's just, it's crazy. And it's outrageous. And it's so outrageous that, you know, only a handful of people would believe it. You know, maybe. And for me, it's now going, you know, he's got to deny this. He's got to come out and say, no, I didn't have sex with that couch. But the memes have been amazing. And the fun and the entertainment have been amazing. And look, normally, this is one of those things where I go, normally, I would go, yeah, it's not right. You shouldn't do this. It's bad. Normally. But look, this is what the Vances of the world, this is what the right has been doing for decades. This kind of gang social media, talk radio, cable news, creation of things that aren't real. And, you know, you think about, you know, the messaging around, you know, they stole the election. No, they didn't. But they repeated enough that people believe it. And understand, I do believe that, you know, at some point there will be people who believe that J.D. Vance, you know, has an eye towards the sofa. And look, some of the memes have been hysterical. My favorite one is with him and Matt Gaetz, where he's going, both of them are looking at a couch, and he goes, you know, that looks like my first. And Matt Gaetz asks, how old? I don't know why that makes me laugh. I mean, because it's not right. It's wrong on so many levels. But there is some potential truth. You know, is he an Ethan Allen guy or a Value City guy? You know, soft or firm cushions? What was that song back in the 80s? Evidently, JD needs a little sectional healing. The jokes just keep going. But the sad reality is this is where our politics have gone and have been for a while. So I have no sympathy for J.D. Vance or the people who have to defend this, because there are going to be actual reporters who are going to go, J.D., and he's going to have to deny it over and over again. And I got to tell you, I think LBJ is looking down on us going, yeah, that's funny. There's some humor in that. The other side is, you know, if Trump does win, the Oval Office has two couches. Will Trump let him in? Because Trump is a germaphobe after all. It is what it is. Now, for me, my problems with JD are not his interest in couches. But the fact that his policies and his ideas are wrong. The fact that, you know, supports this idea of company unions. The things that we've seen come out of him, I struggle with. And I'm not concerned as much as I normally would be that this would suck the oxygen out of the room. I think this is, you know, having a little fun at someone's expense. But I hope we don't get away from just how bad this guy is on women's rights, on workers' rights, on the environment, on all this stuff. And look, this idea that you could remake J.D. Vance into some working class hero, I got to tell you, I'm not buying it on any level. Yeah, he's got a great story. You know, he's got that Horatio Alger story, pull yourself up by your bootstraps with a billionaire's help. For me, that's not enough. I do find it interesting, though. Republicans seem to be having some buyer's remorse because even a lot of the Republican responses that I've been getting, not thrilled with the J.D. Vance choice. And as I always say, you know, when you're looking at a presidential candidate, what's that first decision they make? Picking their running mate. I think this could jump up and bite the Trump, you know, right in the, well, in the behind. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Freespeech.org for the video. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM. W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.